This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's president says that the U.S. needs to remove the obstacles to an agreement on revival of the 2015 nuclear deal. Asian stock markets slide following the broadly negative cues from Wall Street overnight as the Federal Reserve delivers another big interest rate hike to cool galloping inflation. And a 15-year-old Iraqi girl is fatally shot during a live fire drill by the U.S. military near the Abu Ghraib prison located west of the Iraqi capital Baghdad. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian president says obstacles which are impeding, the revival of the 2015 Iran deal should be removed by those who have created them. Speaking to a number of U.S. foreign policy experts in New York, Ebrahim Raisi said Iran has not withdrawn from the agreement and has lived up to its commitments under the accord. Rather, he stressed it was Washington that unilaterally pulled out of the deal, and it's the Europeans that are reneging on their obligations. He said that Tehran approves of talks with the aim of reaching a just and logical outcome. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, who is accompanying President Raisi in his New York trip, told his Irish counterpart Simon Coveney that Tehran is ready for a good and lasting agreement during talks in Vienna on the revival of the JCPOA. He also urged the U.S. as well as Britain, France and Germany to be realistic and show the will to lift sanctions on Iran. Well, as tensions grow in parts of the West Asia region, a senior Iranian military commander warns that his country will not tolerate any redrawing of frontiers.
As we have stated many times, we will not tolerate changes in the borders of the countries of the region, and we advise the countries of Azerbaijan and Armenia to solve their problems through dialogue. We will not tolerate the change of the borders with war, and we will not remain silent.
General Baghdadi's words came as the two South Caucasus countries have seen deadly clashes at their border this month. The Iranian commander also urged Persian Gulf Arab states to remain on the watch for any seditious moves by Israel. The top general said that Iran will strongly confront Zionist elements and their supporters in case of any threats from them. He said the U.S. and Israel pose threats to regional security and expressed hope no such security threats will exist in the future. General Baghdadi made the remarks during a military parade marking Iran's Sacred Defense Week. We're going to go back to our top story for this half hour, focusing on the JCPOA revival talks, where the Iranian president says that obstacles which are impeding the revival of the 2015 Iran deal should be removed by those who have created them. Joining us for further insight on that story, where we have political analyst Said Mostafa Khoshchesh, who's with us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Also joining us in our studio, we have senior research fellow at Center for Middle East Strategic Studies, Mr. Abbas Aslani. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Khoshchesh. Sir, the Iranian president has given a very logical and direct response that the obstacles that are impeding the revival of the 2015 deal should be removed by those who have created them. Help us better understand those comments.
Well, and thanks for having me. Well, it's true. One of the main obstacles to the revival of the nuclear deal is the U.S. being adamant to any kind of strong guarantees for Iran. There's a checklist of guarantees that has been requested by Iran because the U.S. left the deal in 2018. And Iran stayed under the deal for 14 months and with full compliance. And ever since then, it started using mechanism in paragraph 26 in order to modify its undertakings, because it was the only party under the deal doing its commitments. So especially considering now that the U.S., which has been disloyal to this deal, There are debates inside the U.S., as President Raisi said. The Republicans have warned that if they take a majority, if they win the majority in the upcoming elections, then they will torpedo the deal. And there are also debates right now at the Congress that they are going to ratify approvals and bring new laws to contain any kind of deal with Iran and to ask for a review before the deal is signed by the United States. So these show that guarantees are needed more than ever in order to keep the deal stable if we ever arrive at a deal because of this U.S. Stubborn behavior. But let's remember that when we are talking about guarantees, that I said there is a long checklist of them in four categories. One of them is economic guarantees. These guarantees have been requested by European Asian companies that have been telling us in the past 18 months that if you receive any kind of guarantees, it doesn't matter to us. What we want is strong guarantees given to you and us jointly to ensure that if we start the investment in Iran, we would be free, we would not be punished by the U.S. no matter what happens to the JCPOA in future or if the U.S. stays under the deal or not. And they remind us that we know, they say, that the U.S. would withdraw from the deal. It's not loyal to the deal, to any kind of deal, because it believes that it's exceptional. It wants to enhance its, you know, situation under any kind of circumstances, like the last time that they did so. So they say we are investing companies. We need 10, 20 years for investment. Now, if you receive such guarantees that provide us with protection for the length, for the lifetime of our, you know, accords and agreements and contracts with you, that would be fine. Otherwise, we will not trust the U.S. with any kind of a deal, any kind of deal. But this is these guarantees that I'm talking about, these are direct guarantees. We also have the IAEA cases. That's another type of guarantee, because it's completely clear that if Iran goes for a deal, it's for getting rid of all pressures, including the sanctions, as well as IAEA political cases against Iran. It's completely clear that if the IAEA cases remain open in future, the U.S. would resort to them to pressure Tehran and to ask for more concessions or to defy compliance with its undertakings. So they also need to be closed. That's another type of guarantee, actually. Another one that we call guarantee for keeping the case open for future for the United States. These are three, four general overall wordings,
right,
phrases that keep the door open for the United States' future defiance. We have been asking them to narrow down the meaning of these words, general words, so that they would not be able to defy the terms of the deal in future, and they have remained adamant to that. So,
sure,
as you see, all conditions display that the U.S. is not willing to strike a stable deal.
Let's bring in Mr. Abbas Aslani in on the discussion as well. Mr. Aslani, our guest, Mr. Khoshesh, went over some of the crucial aspects of the revival talks. I want to get your thoughts on those as well. And what are, in your opinion, some of the impediments to the revival of the JCPOA at this point?
I think one of the major impediments for revival of the nuclear deal is that the Biden administration is not ready to return to the full compliance with the terms of the nuclear deal, because you know, they were somehow hesitant about, let's say, appeasing those opponents about returning to the nuclear deal. And now that they are facing a midterm election in the United States, they cannot make a decision whether to return or not. So that has been one of the major obstacles along the way as of the beginning of the talks so far. So, and that's why Iranian president in his meetings in New York somehow referred to that Americans' decision is needed for revival of the, let's say, the nuclear deal. But as it was mentioned by the other guest, Iran demands guarantees which can somehow contribute to the durability of the deal. And this can benefit all the parties who want to keep the agreement in place for a longer term. One is that the U.S. has made a record by exiting from the deal, so the assumption of another departure from the agreement is more valid than ever. That's why Iran is insisting on receiving guarantees from the Americans that they would not leave the deal again as it happened in 2018. Because the reason for Tehran to clinch a deal is to economically benefit from the agreement and the accord. If the foreign companies, they assume that the U.S. will exit from the deal and reimpose the sanctions on them, so they will have no reason or, let's say, motivation to engage in economic cooperation with Iran. So this will be in vain, and Iran will not benefit from the deal. There are some other issues vis-a-vis the International Atomic Energy Agency, which are the so-called the safeguard-related issues. Back in March, Iran and the IAEA agreed to close the cases, and they were able to close one of, let's say, issues related to a location in Iran. And they were supposed to resolve the remaining issues in the course of time. But what happened? Because there was no agreement in Vienna in place, the other parties tried to use the IAEA and those issues as a pretext to issue a resolution against Tehran, which today has complicated the process of the talks. So there is no guarantee that, again, in future, the other parties, instead of, let's say, resolving those remaining issues between Iran and the IAEA, would use those, let's say, as a leverage tool against Tehran. And that's why Iran is again insisting on, let's say, closing those issues and demanding a kind of guarantee. Tehran has no hesitation to engage in technical cooperation with the IAEA, but the problem is that some other parties are putting political pressure, and this diverts the agency from its, let's say, technical performance, and from and the nature of its, let's say, function is a technical, let's say, issue. But they have been politicizing the agency, and this can create problems in relations between Iran and the IAEA, followed by, let's say, complicating the process for implementation of the, let's say, the deal which is to be revived. So that's why Iran is insisting on those remaining issues, and I think these two issues related to the guarantees as well as the absence of any decision by Biden administration are considered the major obstacles for reviving the 2015 nuclear deal.
Thank my guest, Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, joining us from Tehran. Also thanks to Mr. Abbas Aslani joining us in our studio. Moving on, Asian markets extend a painful Wall Street sell-off following a further hike in Federal Reserve interest rates. Shares fell in China, Japan, and South Korea on Thursday. Markets in Singapore, Indonesia, and the Philippines were also in the red. That's after all three benchmarks in Wall Street finished more than 1.7% down, with the U.S. Federal Reserve raising interest rates by 0.75% for the third consecutive time this year. The new hike brings the central bank's benchmark interest rate to its highest level since 2008. Fed boss Jerome Powell said the central bank will stay the course with its aggressive measures to bring the 40-year high inflation down. He admitted that such policies would affect the American economy, but said there is no easier way to tackle rising prices. The European Union is planning to impose new sanctions against Russia over Moscow's military operations in Ukraine.
Additional restrictive measures against Russia will be brought forward immediately, as soon as possible, in coordination with our partners.
The EU High Representative added Europe will continue to support Ukraine and provide it with military equipment as long as needed. He also condemned plans for referendums in parts of Ukraine to join Russia. Meanwhile, Russian President Vladimir Putin warned the West that Moscow would use all available means to respond to threats against his country. Putin also ordered Russia's first mobilization since World War II, which would likely add 300,000 reservists to support its military operations in Ukraine. Well, Italy's elections are a few days away. Opinion polls show the leader of far-right Brothers of Italy party is a leading candidate to replace outgoing Prime Minister Mario Draghi. Max Giuli reports from Rome.
Italy is bracing itself for fresh elections on September 25 after the government of national unity led by Mario Draghi collapsed at the end of July. The former president of the European Central Bank and Goldman Sachs managing director Draghi had lost support of the once anti-establishment five-star movement, the League and Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia. These three parties failed to back him in a confidence vote on his leadership, triggering a government crisis that ended with President Sergio Mattarella calling for snap elections. This will be the first time the Italians go to the polls in September in the country's Republican history. According to final polls, a right-wing coalition is on course to win a comfortable majority of seats in both houses of the parliament, with the far-right Brothers of Italy party likely to win about 25% of the vote. Its leader, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni, could be Italy's next prime minister, the Italian media have reported. Her party took around 4% of votes in the last election in 2018. A few days ago, the US government warned that Russian cash had been funneled to Italian parties sympathetic to the Kremlin without specifying which groups had been the recipients of the funds. Some analysts have seen the US move as a warning to those parties which had expressed sympathy for Russian President Vladimir Putin over the past years. Over 51 million Italians are entitled to vote at the weekend. Sunday's elections will be held amid general disaffection and political discredit. Recent surveys have shown that some 35% of the Italians won't show up at the polls, a trend that, if confirmed, could put turnout at a record low. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, a young girl has been fatally shot during a live fire drill by the U.S. military near the Iraqi capital Baghdad. 15-year-old Zainab Isam al-Ghazali was hit by a bullet originated from the Victoria military base near Baghdad International Airport. An Iraqi security source says a probe has been launched into the murder, which is being described as a random shooting. Asaib Ahl al-Haq, a political group, has called the U.S. military action a flagrant breach of Iraqi sovereignty. The U.S. invaded the Arab country in 2003 to oust then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but Washington continues to maintain its troops there under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Iraqis have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the U.S. military presence in the country, calling for them to leave. We were earlier joined by director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson, who gave us his take on the recent killing of a young Iraqi girl near the Abu Ghraib Torture and Detention Center.
It's an awful reminder of the consequences of this almost 20-year-long U.S. occupation in Iraq. And, of course, the shooting happened just near the infamous torture center that the Americans set up in Abu Ghraib. Now, this young girl wasn't even born when the invasion in 2003 took place, but she's the latest of hundreds of thousands of victims of this U.S. occupation. And unfortunately, we have to recognize that one of the key features of any foreign occupation is there will be no accountability. We can be certain that there won't be accountability in Iraq because that's the nature of the occupation they've established with the Iraqi government. They're still in Iraq for the same reason that they're in Syria, for the same reason that they had economic sieges on the entirety of West Asia. They are trying to fragment and weaken that whole region to prevent the resistance emerging and creating a strong and prosperous region. They want to weaken and divide people, as empires always do, to try and maintain their own influence in the world. And this is the West Asia is a very important region in between Europe and Asia, where the greatest struggles of our time are going on.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. Another great achievement you've made is that this government has refrained from blaming others and making excuses. And it has accepted responsibility for the actions it has taken. During this time, we haven't heard any government official say, they won't let us do anything, we don't have any authority over such and such is out of our hand. We haven't heard these things from you. Accepting responsibility for your actions is truly important. You say, we are here, we need to get the job done, and we will get the job done. This is a very positive, important point. Another important point is that good approaches are being taken in the fields of foreign policy and culture. Now, these approaches, especially in the cultural fields, will take time to be implemented. But there are positive approaches. They need to be followed up. They are another of your accomplishments. The slogans of the revolution have gained emphasis, as have the slogans of Islam. Slogans such as seeking justice, avoiding luxuries, supporting the oppressed, and standing against arrogance. These are the main slogans of the revolution. These matters have been emphasized and been clearer in people's speech, and this is a great thing. Continue with it.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You try to continue with these accomplishments. I shall talk about these more when I am making my recommendations. In any case, consistent work is needed in all fields. This was about the first part, your achievements. As for my recommendations, I have a few suggestions. My first word of advice, which I have given to most of the governments that have been formed in recent years, is that first of all, you should be grateful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for blessing you with the opportunity to serve people.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to Iran and the UN General Assembly this year, one of the questions asked was whether the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi would meet and talk with the U.S. President Joe Biden. The answer was pretty clear.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen. I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
But this issue should not be the focus, because Iran's presence at this year's assembly means so much more than just whether Raisi will meet Biden or not. So much has changed since Ibrahim Raisi spoke at last year's UNGA.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Iran is the land of culture and civilization.
The transformation of Iran from just a year ago to the current Islamic Republic today is quite remarkable, especially on the international arena. But how has Iran changed? For example, Ibrahim Raisi has been able to turn the table when it comes to harsh and cruel U.S. bilateral sanctions. His administration has turned Iran's economy around, with Iran's GDP and foreign trade to have increased. No easy task when it comes to it being executed. Another example? He kept true to his word and did not link Iran's economic challenges or progress to the JCPOA revival or sanctions removal talks. That has had an impact on an international level, since he showed in action that economic problems could be solved without a deal with the U.S. and some Western countries. Furthermore, when it comes to negotiations, Iran is not negotiating from a weak economic position. An economy that is rebounding strongly, it has beaten the maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. exerted on it. The important achievements of this administration can be seen here. They have elevated Iran's standing, not only domestically, but also on the world stage. And the reason why this is important is because it flies smack in the face of U.S. and Western sanctions, showing how Iran can withstand these unilateral coercive measures and progress at the same time. This is what the UN Charter, Article 2, states. All members shall settle their international disputes by peaceful means, in such a manner that international peace and security and justice are not endangered. A comparative look between Iran versus the U.S. makes it glaringly clear that the U.S. is acting in the opposite direction of this charter. It has indeed taken a militaristic approach when it comes to making a choice between war and peace. It is worth noting that to this day, Iran has not invaded any country or indeed started a war in more than two centuries, something that the U.S. cannot claim. As a matter of fact, recently Iran may have set a new record for hosting foreign dignitaries. In a matter of 1 week, not a day went by when a high-ranking official was not in Iran, which included figures like the Russian President Vladimir Putin and the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the likes. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi will be making his presence coming up fresh from his appearance at the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. This is important, since Iran has become a permanent member of this organization. And the reason for this importance is, unlike claims made by the U.S. and the West, Iran is an important fixture on the world stage.
In recent years, political and economic multilateralism has come under serious threat. The U.S. government is trying to impose its demands and domestic law on the international system and sovereign countries through outright bullying and coercion. Washington's unilateralism is undoubtedly aimed at hampering independent countries' progress.
The SCO is the world's largest regional organization, covering approximately 60% of the area of Eurasia, 40% of the world population, and more than 30% of the global GDP. Yet a recent incident took place that did not get much coverage, but it displayed how the Islamic Republic has peaceful intentions when it comes to conflicts and can act as a mediator. It had to do with the Ukraine conflict. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, delivered a European peace initiative on Ukraine to Russia, in which Iran said it had received the proposal from an anonymous European leader. This squarely pits Iran's peaceful intentions against the U.S. warmongering policy when it comes to Ukraine. So, when Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi takes the podium, representing Iran and its peaceful intentions, like its peaceful nuclear program, it is showing how Iran deserves the respect that it is entitled to, not the sanctions and embargoes imposed by the West and the U.S. Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
The bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline, criticism intensifies after big oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists, like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today, we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
Big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change. We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for the shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. To get the full impact of what these energy conglomerates are doing, the bare facts need to be known. According to a report published by the Carbon Majors Database in 2017, just 100 of them have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. If fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017, global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What is shocking is that these large corporations like Exxon knew about climate change almost 50 years ago. In 2015, it was revealed that Exxon understood the science before it became a public issue. It was called the Climate Deception Dossiers.
The reality of global warming began making front-page headlines nearly 30 years ago. That's when the world's largest fossil fuel companies launched a three-decade campaign to deceive the public and delay action on climate change.
The worst part about these findings was that ExxonMobil spent millions of dollars to promote misinformation about the issue. The goal? To sow doubt about climate change. Let that sink in. Because these dossiers revealed that the coalition of fossil fuel companies had launched a big communications effort to sow doubt. Their motto, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Then in 2019, it was reported that major global firms were accused of concealing their environmental impact. This included more than 700 companies like Facebook, Amazon, Tesco, and here we go again, ExxonMobil. They were accused of lacking transparency over things like water shortages and deforestation. How these non-oil and gas companies do this is that they do what's called greenwashing, conveying a false impression that one's products are environmentally friendly or sound, when in essence they are not. And here are some of the companies that are guilty of this. Famous brands known the world over, claiming that they have gone green, but in essence they have not. Whether it was the Paris Climate Accord or COP26.
And we arrive at what I believe is the moment of truth.
Or John Kerry.
It is time to come together for future generations in ways that none of us really ever thought we might have an opportunity to do.
All of that appears to be on the shelf for now. With a lack of energy resources, European countries and the U.S. are scrambling to fill the shortages, even if it includes resorting to big CO2 emitters like fossil fuels. On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. He has said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain? South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces, compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in his neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase "the U.S. losing its superpower status" continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, "We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with." It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including 2 children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. The weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the US, UK, Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staff by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the country's east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The UK's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they're fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. And a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nisour Square massacre.
It's Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Last Savior. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much and thanks for inviting me to your show.
Well, we have been talking about the relationship between Ashura and Masawiyat, and we came across so many points like, who is Sufyani? Who are the ones who are going to be taken revenge from in this time? Who are the criminals of the time? And how revenge is discussed in the narrations, how Ashura is going to be recognized by all. And what are the similarities between Imam Hussein and Imam Zaman ajallahu ta'ala faraja in terms of social and political perspective? Now, Dr. Alavi, since we talked about the similarities of the Imams themselves, are there any similarities between their companions as well?
As for the companions of the Imam, we have read and we have seen in the history of Ashura that number of companions of Imam were few. Some say 72, some say more or less.
Yeah.
At most, I mean, some say 120.
Yeah.
And some even less than this number. So we know that the numbers of the real companions of Imam were few. And Imam said, I don't know anyone better than my companions.
Right.
And we talked about the reason that why they are known, as I think earlier. We said that because they knew that they will all get martyred. And
yeah.
they knew that there won't be any way out of that battlefield anymore.
Yeah.
So that's why they knew, and while purposely knew that, stood to the last minute and helped Imam. Again, we have with the some hadith that has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam about the companions of Imam Zaman. They have been even introduced among the sincere companions, and they were introduced as they are more, as Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they are more obedient to their Imam than maidservants and slaves. So from the viewpoint of their submission to Imam, they are highly submitted to the orders of their Imam.
Okay.
And the number of the companions of the Imam are 313.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean that the rest of the people are not going to help Imam Zaman alayhi salam. No. These 313 are the numbers of the, let's say, leaders of the troops of Imam.
Okay.
Definitely there will be
the
some.
The first circle, we can
yeah.
say.
But this is very beautiful to know. In both, there are some ladies and women that, inshallah, later on, we shall talk about that, about the role of ladies and the number of ladies in Imam Hussein army and Imam Zaman army.
You talked about women. Women
yeah.
have been there in Ashura as well, although jihad mm. is not obligatory on women. But we have seen a very pious role, very tremendous role played by women in the event of Ashura.
Yeah.
Do we have women as well playing some role in the event of the advent of Imam Zaman as well? I'll ask you that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay
okay.
tuned to IRIP English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior, and we're talking about the relationship between Ashura and Mathaviyat. And right now, we're talking about the similarities between the companions of Imam Hussein and Imam Zaman Ajallah Ta'ala Faraja. Dr. Alawi, you said before break that the role of women. So what had been the role of women in Ashura itself and in the event of uprising of Imam Zamana?
About the role of women, everyone knows, all of us know, at least the followers of the school have a little bit better know than the others, that when we have anything left from the story of Karbala, it's because of the role of women in that land.
Okay.
If we have something as the story of Ashura and whatever has been left as the literature of that time is due to the role of great lady of Islam, Lady Zainab Salamullah Alayha.
Yes.
So if there was no Zainab in that history, there was nothing left from Karbala to us. So
even like that Persian poet says.
What bigger and what more important than this role can we find anywhere else?
Yes. Especially she acted as a media in the time of desert,
mm-hmm.
when there was no other media, when
yeah.
there was very difficult to convey any message, and especially in the time of confronting so many tragedies, because a person is down, he's not able to control or compose himself.
Yeah.
But in that state, Lady Zainab Salamullah is acting as a media.
Definitely.